As the Iraqi war on Iran drew to an end with no significant achievement for the Iraqi strongmen, signs of despair and distrust began to bubble up in the rank and file of the Ba'ath Army, bringing the country to the verge of a revolt against Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But the dictator's scheme saved his power. At Saddam Hussein's order, the Ba'ath military camps received Rajavi's group between 1988 and 1991. The aim was to give the MKO members special military training with modern weapons. At the time, no one knew when and where the training and the weapons would be used. Not only did the Mujahideen-e Khalq organization resemble the Ba'ath Party in appearance, also efforts were made to inculcate into the members the idea that ordinary people would be enemy number one for them. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He wanted to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war on Iran, and also to find a way out for the country's deteriorating economy. But the dictator made miscalculations. All his once Western and Arab supporters stood against him. He was doomed to defeat in this war as well. On March 3, 1991, one day after the Persian Gulf War ceasefire, a T-72 tank gunner, returning home after Iraq's defeat in Kuwait, fired a shell into a colossal portrait of Saddam Hussein hanging over Basra's main square. The revolt in Basra was first led by Colonel Mohammad Ibrahim Wali, an Iraqi army officer. He attacked some government buildings and prisons in the city. Backed by a majority of the population, the uprising led to the fall of Basra into the hands of the dissidents. On the same day, in Najaf, a demonstration near Imam Ali Mosque became a gun battle between army deserters and Saddam's security forces. People seized control of the city. The uprising spread within days to all of the big Shia cities in South Iraq. Amara, Diwaniya, Hilla, Karbala, Kut, Nasiriyah, and Samawa. Now, the initial protest had turned into a widespread uprising in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. 3 days after the start of the uprising in the south, which was also referred to as the Sha'ban Intifada due to its concurrence with the month of Sha'ban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. The situation had spun out of control. The intelligence service and the army seemed impotent in the face of such big an event. The dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history. The so-called National Liberation Army of Iran, commanded by Masoud Rajavi, an army Saddam Hussein had long counted on. When When the uprising began, Masood Rajavi was located in a base called Light One in Karbala. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of him and his organization. Soon after, he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the people so as to identify the leaders of the uprising. Along with a number of his intelligence agents, Masood headed for Camp Ashraf in Diyala, in the north of Baghdad. Because they were Iranian nationals, the MKO members could go freely among the ordinary people and revolutionaries. Therefore, they handed in the names of prominent revolutionaries along with their addresses to the Iraqi intelligence service, known also as the Mukhabarat. Within a short span of time, the leaders of the revolution were arrested and sentenced to death in the worst ways possible, including throwing off a height, beheading, being cut into pieces in big industrial meat grinders, being dissolved in sulfuric acid, and being blown up with TNT in their pockets. Those killed during the uprisings were among the luckiest. The other group had a fate worse than death. They were subjected to brutal tortures. Their fate had to be a salutary lesson. Breaking arms and fingers were among the simplest tortures in the Ba'ath prisons during the crackdown on the 1991 uprisings in Iraq. All that was possible with the help of Saddam Hussein's private army. That's the MKO, headed by Masood Rajavi. The help the MKO gave Saddam Hussein was not limited to identifying the leaders of the 1991 uprisings. After the suppression of the uprisings, they paved the way for the Ba'ath army to enter the city of Karbala. In the conflict between the people and the MKO forces in Karbala, three forces who were among MKO's special agents were killed by the people. These three were later buried in Marvarid Ashraf Cemetery. The three were the whole casualties of the MKO during the 1991 uprisings. But there are still thousands of people unaccounted for. They disappeared during the uprisings. Years later, 3 days after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the faint glimmer of hope to find them blew out, as there was nothing to be found about them in the remaining documents in Abu Ghraib prison.
Thank you.
The discovered mass graves only revealed the fate of a number of these disappeared citizens. Many families were still waiting to hear about their missing members. That's why the MKO-TV claimed that more than 5 million Iraqi people have signed a petition calling for the MKO to be granted freedom of action in Iraq. When the BBC called the petition a fraud, the organization sarcastically labeled the news network Ayatollah BBC. In a report commissioned by the Pentagon, Rand Corporation, a nonprofit institute, writes that the signatures are falsified. The 1991 uprisings in the South were suppressed with the help of the MKO. But their next mission in the North was much more horrifying. Rajavi's army, as the most equipped unit in Saddam Hussein's Greater Army, undertook a mission that later came to be known as the Anfal Genocide. Those who spend years in these prisons have not forgotten tortures by the Ba'ath interrogators. The 1991 uprisings in South Iraq broke out when the Ba'ath army had fallen apart after being defeated in the First Persian Gulf War. But with the great service the MKO provided Saddam Hussein with, by spying for the intelligence service and identifying the leaders of the uprisings, the popular movement soon came to an end. Once again, the Ba'ath army took control of the cities in South Iraq. Prisons became full of prisoners whose fate never came to light. The prisons of Basra and other southern cities were packed with prisoners who had been told on by MKO spies. But these prisoners were not the only victims of the MKO service to Saddam Hussein's regime. The total catastrophe for the Iraqi Kurds was on the way. A catastrophe caused again by this man and his organization, Masoud Rajavi and his organization called the MKO. A reportage prepared by the MKO TV states that South Iraq is under the control of rebels, alluding to the 1991 uprisings and the popular movements in that area. With the outbreak of the 1991 uprisings in the south, Kurdish fighters joined the rebellion against the Ba'ath regime. When the Ba'ath party had lost its power as a result of the defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, the fighters succeeded in controlling the heights and the Kurdish populated cities in the north. In addition, the Kurdish fighters managed to bring under control some areas in West Iraq. The streets of Khanarin were scattered with the bodies of the Ba'ath soldiers. The time was ripe for the fighters to go to Baghdad and topple the dictator. But in the absence of the Ba'ath army, there was an equipped army to block their way in North Baghdad. That army was nothing but the Mujahideen Khalq organization. The organization had been missioned to block the Kurds' way to the capital city before complete suppression of the uprisings in the south and the arrival of Ba'ath reinforcements. On March 25, 1991, the Ba'ath military forces finally managed to completely suppress the popular movement in the south. After 2 weeks of bloodshed, and go to help the MKO. With their arrival, the military oppression against the Kurds began. It was called by Masoud Rajavi as Operation Pearl One, as it happened in the heights of the same name. Although the Kurdish fighters had been blocked on their way to Baghdad, they still had northern cities under control. At that time, the MKO had advanced on the heart of the Kurdish strongholds, and therefore had been surrounded by them. But when the Ba'ath army couldn't penetrate the Kurds, the MKO deceived them. In their own separate report, Australia's Parliamentary Committee on Foreign Relations and the U.S. State Department, as well as RAND Corporation, have revealed the role of Masoud Rajavi in the Anfal genocide and his help to keep Saddam Hussein in power. In its report, RAND refers to a statement by Rajavi encouraging the MKO forces to take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Saddam Hussein gave Rajavi the Rafahuddin Medallion, a high honor in the Iraqi military, for his role in suppressing the Kurds. The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of the Kurds in these areas. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives due to the cold, hunger, and difficulty of the situation. Many others went missing. A majority of them are still unaccounted for.
He could destroy Saddam and his army, but he don't try. All this because he don't want Kurdish and Shia to be leader in Iraq, to run Iraq. Why did he do that? He could destroy the army. We could live in peace. The war is finished. He destroyed Kuwait. Kuwait is 1 million. 1 million, he do this all war for 1 million. We are 5 million.
After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing members. Mass graves found in prison yards dashed the hopes of these families to find their long missing members. suppressing, quelling the 1991 uprisings, and playing a central role in the Amphal genocide. Massoud Rajavi helped the Iraqi dictator remain in power for another 12 years. In return, Saddam Hussein gave him a free rein in his territory.
Saddam's regime is over.
In 2003, the Iraqi people saw a day when the country's dictator was finally arrested. He was put on trial for the mass killing of the Iraqi people and then sentenced to death. But no one asked about his right-hand man in committing crimes against the Iraqis. Massoud Rajavi disappeared in the chaos of falling Saddam Hussein.
هؤلاء يجب أن يلحقوا بهؤلاء ليس هناك ملفا آخرا إنما ملفهم مرتبط بملفات إجرام صدام وحزب البعث.
Rajavi knew well that Saddam Hussein's fate could be his. Camp Ashraf, November 2013. Long after the fall of Saddam Hussein, the MKO members remained in Camp Ashraf under the protection of the U.S. forces while trying to show legitimate their presence on the Iraqi soil. Now years have passed. It's been years since the presence of Massoud Rajavi in Iraq, and Camp Ashraf has turned into a ghost city. The MKO members couldn't justify their presence in Iraq anymore. Evacuating the camp, they moved under the protection of the U.S. forces to a camp in Baghdad called Liberty, where their cost of living is paid out of the Iraqi people's pockets and where they live in complete security. Who knows? Perhaps Massoud Rajavi and his terrorist organization have been saved by the powers that be to be hired once again in the future.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an introduction to the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, and ulama. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum and thank you.
At the very beginning of this program, I would like to express my condolences on behalf of myself and all the staff of Call of Islam page, Arab English Radio, for the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. That's why I decided to dedicate this series of the program in the month of Muharram and Safar to the scholars whose one of works, at least, is about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Qaini Mujtahid Birjandi, mainly also known as Muhammad Baqir Ayati and Muhaddis Birjandi, the author of the magnum opus Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharaat al-Manba. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the biography of Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Also, I would like to express my condolences on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions. Regarding Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi, we have to say that this outstanding sheikh is born to a religious family in one of the villages of Birjand, which is located in the east of Iran. Then when he was 12 years old, he goes to Qa'an, actually the the closest place for the studying near to their villages. And then from there, he moves to three religious cities, starting from Mashhad. Then till he is 20 years old, he stays in Mashhad. And then from there, he goes to Najaf, stays for a couple of years over there, benefiting from the great ulama, Mirza Habibullah Rashti.
Yes.
And also, Marhum Akhund Khurasani. You know, to have the name of these great scholars as your teachers, it will express that where you are, I mean, how you have benefited from the knowledge of the great ulama of Islam. And then he moves to Samira. So we have a sheikh who has compiled the experiences and knowledge, yes, of the scholars of three main cities for, yes, Shias, namely Mashhad, Najaf, and also Samira. And when he was in Samira, he benefited from the founder of the seminary of Samira, Mirza Shirazi,
that's right.
Yes, and then, okay, he comes back. When he is done with his study, he comes back to Iran and start his lessons and also going up the member. And the main book that today, inshallah, we have dedicated our program with, Kibritul Ahmar fi Shara'at al-Mimbar, is talking about the rituals, customs, and adab,
yes,
of the member. All for the one who is going up the member,
yes,
and those who are benefiting from the member.
They say that he had also mastery over the fatwas, we can say, and verdicts of the other denominations of Islam, up to an extent that he establishes dialogue and conversations with them, answering them based on their own reasonings and their own books. It shows that he was really a high caliber Ayatollah and Sheikh on that time. But as I said, since we are in the month of Muharram and we want to talk more about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we are looking for an excuse to talk about him. What the best excuse than an author who compiled a work, or it's better to say his magnum opus, on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Sharaat al-Mimbar, we can say is the outstanding work of this man, Muhammad Baqir Qaini Birjandi. What is this book exactly?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sallallahu alayki wa Abu Abdullah. Assalamu alayki wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. One of the outstanding features of the Shia denomination in the whole Islamic world is that a member isn't merely a pulpit or isn't merely a podium for delivering lectures. Rather, member is a place or a space given to a high-ranking cleric, Shia cleric, in order to educate people, in order to give them informal education.
Very
because
good.
I mean, education can be divided into formal education, as one may receive in high schools or universities, in contrast to informal education, which can be gained, I mean, in the mosques, masajid, or Husseinias, and so on. From this perspective, it must be indicated that when such a great dignitary like the late Ayatollah Khomeini Birjandi, dedicated a book on the qualifications or the necessary traits that any cleric must have in order to deliver a set of lectures on religious topics.
That's right.
While ascending a member, it indicates that this space shouldn't be left without its own standards. Rather, yes, it must be quite well disciplined.
Especially when it is about Imam al-Hussein,
yes, alayhi salam, certainly.
Because the passionate aspect of, yes, the story of Karbala
and
there.
It proves more influential,
yes,
for people.
Yes.
Okay? Because ordinary people may not accept anything when you say to them in the street. However, when they receive the same piece of information while listening to a lecture given to them from,
yes,
the top of a member, okay, they would, in a great majority of cases, they accept.
Okay.
In this book, Kibrit Ahmar has got two main sections.
Yes.
Two major sections. One of them is concerned with the qualifications and status of member, and another one is the benefit and the virtues of giving advice to other people.
That's right.
Backed and supported by Quranic verses or authentic hadiths. And then another one, second chapter of the book talks about who may have the qualification, the right qualification, both from the point of piety or from the point of knowledge, to ascend a member in order to deliver a lecture from there.
That's all right.
The third chapter of the book talks
about... So there are two parts. Part one consists of four chapters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Chapter three talks about the qualifications expected from the audience to have.
Yes.
they must be ready. They must be a state of alacrity in order,
yes,
to receive these lectures.
Okay.
And mainly, what must be observed in any commemorative session held in memory of the Ahl al-Bayt. And the fourth chapter of the book talks about, various qualifications expected from a well-designed member,
yes,
in order to be,
okay,
influential for people.
That's all right.
Yes.
And the second part, I think we have,
yes,
some pieces of,
okay,
advice, how to,
yes,
preach for Imam al-Hussein or something like that.
Yes. In the second part of the book, three important, topics or, standards are given. In that, okay, how, for example, the
orator,
sad aspects,
yes,
of,
okay,
the life and times of the infallibles should be given.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is concerned with some other characteristics are concerned with the guidance oriented aspects of,
yes,
delivering lectures,
okay,
and how to manage
that's right,
the member,
because direct.
Yes, yes.
A nice ceremony for Imam al-Hussein.
Yes. For example,
yes,
university professors, when they enter their own, mm-hmm, classes, okay, they,
okay,
must be able how to,
okay,
start the lecture,
yes,
how to develop the topic and how to come to a conclusion at the end of the session.
That's all right.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان
شيخ مهتبي. So we can say in this way the member and giving a speech on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on a pulpit, but the orators and we can say the speakers and the presenters, is really a serious task, as Ayatollah Birjandi believed in, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. That is a serious task, and it gives more emphasis when we look at the position of Ayatollah Birjandi.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some average-level scholars may author some books regarding Imam Hussein, but when you see a scholar who has reached the level of ijtihad and got permission from outstanding scholars like Mirzai Shirazi for the Ijtihad.
Yes.
Then, under the supervision of his ustad, that it is because it is mentioned that Mirzai Shirazi is indicating, or it's better to say, Mirzai Shirazi is offering that with this knowledge and this skill for you, it's better to start writing. And when he offers the first copy of his book, not specifically this book, but the one of the book, because his books reach 70 volumes in different field of studies.
Yes.
So with this position to master different knowledges and different sciences regarding the religious sciences, you see, we have the book regarding the how to observe the conditions and situation in relation to Minbar al-Hussein.
Or Majlis al-Hussein.
Yes, or Majlis al-Hussein. So it will emphasize the position of this point.
Yes.
That that is not an easy task to be taken by any scholar any level.
So you mean it needs its own experts in order to go on Minbar and give a speech, and not any maybe not any type of, we can say, a scholar or an alim is capable or talented enough or powerful enough in a speech to give on Minbar, especially in the case of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which we can say has the passion and the knowledge and the historical, we can say, knowledge is very much needed.
And sometimes we see that there are some distortion.
Okay, very good.
Have taken place,
and distortions, that's
right. In the history of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his martyrdom and his loyal companions. Okay. So you have to reach the level of expertise, you know, in order to differentiate between the truth and false stories. That's why we see one of the subjects that he deals with in his book is about the distortions.
That's right. Continuing the path of his master, Muhaddis Nuri, on the book Lolo Var Marjan, you know, Lolo and Marjan, because that book was also about answering such deviations and distortions which found their way into the story of Karbala and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And unfortunately, sometimes on the manaber and the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are being reiterated, which are absolutely wrong. And Muhammad Baghir Birchandi, can say, tries to answer such deviations, distortions, and misunderstandings about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Kibrit Ahmar fi Sharait al-Manbar. What does Kibrit Ahmar refer to over here in this title?
Yes, this Kibrit al-Ahmar, as we have the equivalent in English, Kibrit al-Ahmar, better to explain it for our listeners, means that stone that magician were looking after in order to change copper into gold. So it's a metaphoric name, although it's got its literal meaning, red sulfur.
Yes.
But the metaphorical meaning of that is that stone that they were looking after in order to change copper into gold.
So you mean Muhammad Baghir Mirjandi can say,
to make a shortcut
Okay. If someone wants to get a member and being a nice presenter on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he needs to make his copper into a gold, isn't it?
Yes, and whatever he is in need of, find it.
Okay.
Find it
in order to improve yourself, is better to say. That's all right. Really nice title. Dr. Fakhwani, anything missed about this book or Sheikh Muhammad Baghir Bijandi?
One point is that, I guess, I mean, a synopsis of the book, or, for example, a brief version of the of these books should be put into English.
Yes.
Because, I mean, nowadays we find that in English-speaking nations, some Shia orators send members or go to the podium in order to deliver lectures.
Yes.
And in order to prevent them from making some inadvertent mistakes, it's necessary to provide them with this kind of experience, again, related or, for example, reported in this region of the world. Perhaps some of these, I mean, anecdotes or suggestions may help them not to go astray while delivering such lectures. Yes.
Especially nowadays that the members are replaced with some of the virtual, we can say, on the social media member or something like that. But we know that the member for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam needs its own qualifications, their starting point, we can say, the stories that are mentioned, even the eulogies and the elegies and the lamentations that are done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam have their own etiquettes. So all of these etiquettes have to be observed according to religious laws and Islamic laws. And if they are not observed truly, they are deviated from the right path.
Certainly.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Thank you much, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrani and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, about Muhammad Baqir Birjandi, the author of the magnum opus, Kibrit al-Ahmar fi Sharait al-Minbar, which was about the best qualifications, or better say, attributes of giving a good lecture on the minbar about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This outstanding man, that is the late Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Birjandi, passed away on Zilhajjah 14, the year 1352, according to the lunar Hiji calendar, at the age of 56. His body, we can say, was taken to a Madrasa Elmiya, or Islamic school, Islamic seminary of the Birjand called Masumiya, and he was buried in a special chamber or gravesite, which is, we can say, place for them, and he was buried in the school, in the same school. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man and all the people who dedicated their lives to write and to work on the Islamic sciences, Islamic knowledge, especially about Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam, this true legacy for the whole Muslim world to learn from and to benefit from. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, to another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary who compiled a work, at least, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Assalamu alayka ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا O you who believe, اِسْتَعِينُوا بِالصَّبْرِ وَالصَّلَاةِ
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam Al-Hujja Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif and to each and every one of you as we gather on this evening and on these nights to commemorate the tragedy that befell upon the family of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam. Tonight we remember the two children of Abdullah bin Ja'far al-Tayyar and the children of Zainab, Aun and Muhammad. Two young boys, according to certain narrations, some say they were 10 and 12, some say 9 and 11, Allahu A'lam, but they were young, yeah, with Aun being the older. But you know, tonight as we tell their martyrdom and we tell their story, I want us today to cry for Zainab alayhi salam. Because Zainab had to sacrifice so much. Karbala is successful because of the stand of Aba Abdullah and the perseverance of Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam. And so my father and mother be sacrificed for Zainab. You know, there Zainab has so many beautiful titles. Zainab has the title of Zahida. Zainab has the title of Aqilatu Bani Hashim, the one with the most intellect. Yeah? She has the title of Alima bi ghayri Muallima. Yeah? The Alima, the one who is a scholar without having been taught. But you know the most heart-wrenching of titles? Zainab is called Ummul Masai. The mother of those who have seen musibah. The mother of those who have seen difficulties. You know, Zainab saw more difficulties than Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Zainab's difficulties was when she began, when she was a young child, when Rasulullah was in his deathbed. And she saw how the ummah disrespected the Prophet in his own house. Afterwards, she was present when they came and slapped the face of Fatima al-Zahra. And when Fatima would cry out, Ya Abata, Zainab watched the cries of her mother. She endured it. She saw how the religion of Islam changed in 25 years. She was there in Kufa when Ali was struck on the head by the Mal'oon. And when Ali was being brought back to the house, you know, the riwayat, some say that he saw Zainab from the corner of his eyes. My heart, you know, asks wonders, because Ali was so beautiful that if he said to Hassan and Hussein, put me down, let me walk the rest of the way, they would say, Ya Bata, how? She says, I don't want Zainab to see this yet. Zainab has more to see. Zainab saw her brother Hassan being poisoned and the effects of those poisons. Zainab saw how the lash of Hassan left the house and they shot arrows that she endured. She endured all of this. And then we come to Karbin Wabala. And what Zainab alayhi salam had to endure in Karbala. You know, on the night of Ashura, we see how companions used to encourage each other, how mothers used to encourage their children who are about to go the next day. You know, I think about that too. Imagine the hearts of the mothers in Karbala, knowing that the next day the children that they had raised were going towards martyrdom, and they encouraged, they didn't come with any weakness for their children. They encouraged their children. And likewise, Zainab must have encouraged Aun and Muhammad, reminding them, oh Aun, oh Muhammad, you have the blood of Ali bin Abi Talib flowing through you. Oh Aun, oh Muhammad, you have the blood of Ja'far al-Tayyar flowing through you. You will be my sacrifice tomorrow for Imam alayhi salam. We say salam to you, Ya Ummul Masai. Salam to you. Because this is not the only thing you will sacrifice. You will sacrifice your hijab, Zainab. You will sacrifice every your freedoms, Zainab. There is more sacrifice that you have to give. On the day of Ashura, when all the companions had gone, it became time for the Banu Hashim to go. You know, it was the custom and the way of Imam al-Hussein. Not a custom. It was the heart of Hussein. That whenever his nephews would come, he would not let them go, He wouldn't. Qasim would come. We'll talk about Qasim tomorrow. Imam would not let Qasim go. The sons of Muslim came. Imam would not let the sons of Muslim go. Aun and Muhammad came. There is no way the Imam alayhi salam let Aun and Muhammad go. I wonder if every time Zainab saw Aun and Muhammad, she would say, my sons, why are you still alive? You are my sacrifice. Go and sacrifice your lives. I wonder if Zainab would come to Imam al-Hussein at this time and say to her brother, oh Aba Abdullah, have I ever asked you for anything? Have I ever asked you for anything before? Today I ask you to take my children and let them be sacrificed. It is said these two boys went out and they fought bravely. These were the boys who were trained by Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. These were the boys who were trained by Ali ibn al-Akbar. They had Ali's blood. They fought. According to certain narrations, Aun killed 13. Muhammad killed 10. But at the end of the day, these were boys. They were surrounded and eventually they were struck down. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with the companions brings the boys back to the Khaymaqah. You know, my brothers and sisters, that when Ali ibn al-Akbar fell, Zainab ran out to the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar screaming, Ya Habiba! Yabna Akha, oh my dear, oh the son of my brother. But I searched with all my heart, that when Aun and Muhammad fell, Zainab did not come out. Zainab could not be found. Why? I wonder if Zainab was sitting in her khaymah saying to Allah, Ya Allah, taqabbal minna hadhal qurban, accept from me this sacrifice. But look at the akhlaq of Zainab too. Zainab knew that if she would cry for her children, this would hurt the heart of Imam al-Hussein. Like we said yesterday, there are layers of akhlaq even in shahadat of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Zainab knew that if she ever had her brother here, Ya Auna, Ya Muhammada, Hussein would have felt that I wish I hadn't let them go. And so Zainab never cried. But my brothers and sisters, there was a time when Zainab returned back to Medina. There will be a time when Zainab returns back to Medina, and that she sits with her husband Abdullah, and then she sees the two little beds of her children. At this time, Zainab will cry for Aun and Muhammad. At this time, she will weep over the sacrifice. My brothers and sisters, I wish this was the end of the musibah of Aun of Sayyidah Zainab. But this is not why only she is called Ummul Masaib. The musibah of Zainab continues much more after this. She will still have to see the hands of Abbas being cut. She will still have to see the arrow pierce the throat of Ali ibn al-Aswad. She will still have to see Imam al-Hussein bid farewell. The only male helper left, Imam, would go. But the musibah of Kufa and Sham is waiting for you, Zainab. The difficulties of being taken as prisoners, behijaba, without hijab, without a male protector to be there. You know, this musibah, my brothers and sisters, this musibah of Kufa to Sham was something that the Ahlul Bayt never ever forgot. And it hurt them more than even the shahadat of Imam al-Hussein. You know, it is said Imam Sajjad would cry. He would lament. Until Abu Hamza Samali comes to him. He says, Ya Sayyidi, ma hazal buka? What is this crying, Sayyidi? Your uncle Hamza was a shaheed. Imam Ali was a shaheed. Imam al-Hasan was a shaheed. Inna qatla lakumul aada wa karamatukum min Allahi shahada. He says to them that qatl, martyrdom, is a way of lineage for you. It's a legacy for you, and it is an honor from Allah. The Imam says, Shakarakallah ya Aba Hamza. That what you say is true, O Aba Hamza. That indeed, martyrdom is a legacy for us. It is an honor for us. But he says, Ya Aba Hamza. Ya Aba Hamza, have you ever heard women and children from the Aal of Rasulullah being taken as prisoners the way my aunt Zainab was? He says that every time I see my aunt Zainab, every time I see my sisters, I can see them running from tents to tents trying to... wa Zainaba wa Madluma fasayalamu alladhina zalamu ayyam qalbiyan qalibun.
I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
See you too.
Tuman.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Whether man-made or not, food can have fascinating backstories. Products usually take a long journey before they end up on the dining table. Nevertheless, the food industry follows several golden rules that have helped it steadily grow over time. The most important of these is continuous product innovation and improved production processes to reduce costs and wastage. Others involve packaging and product accessibility, but probably the king of all rules is the taste that drives the food industry.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we will be exploring the food industry and its related agricultural markets. We wanted to see how the food sector has expanded over the years and what companies are doing to increase their profits. So let's check out the Tasty Grub.
To become more familiar with how much work goes into food production, we visited Golha Food Industries. It was established nearly a century ago, and its products are now a household name. It produces hundreds of items in seven categories, such as dried legumes and fruit, spices and canned products. It also takes great pride in its healthy product line, including gluten-free flour products. This producer has devoted a lot of attention to the packaging of its products. Due to its diverse product list, it purchases such materials as cans, plastic, and cardboard to design the appropriate type of storage systems for distribution. The company has a massive daily output due to its expansive production facilities. Most of the work is done by automated machines, but the fine details are handled by experienced staff. All production processes start when raw material enters the company. These materials are first tested for quality before hitting the production floors, most of which are domestically supplied. After being tested, the material is sent to various closed circuit machines for processing. Then it is time for sorting and more quality control tests before packaging.
Food production is a very sensitive process requiring many checks and controls that guarantee the final product is safe for consumption. And production machines play an essential role as they reduce errors and maintain constant output results. Plus, many of these machines have been domestically engineered, whereas they were previously imported at high prices.
This company has a highly equipped quality control and research and development lab. It's where many new products are created and food safety standards are controlled. Moreover, the staff in this department implement food sciences to make innovative products. It might be interesting to know that this department also has some of the best food tasters. This producer has been awarded Best Research and Development Department in Food Production for many consecutive years. Among its many achievements,